This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Welfare reform, immigration, labor policy, and health care. Today, Senator Edward Kennedy's economic legacy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Scratchpad blog. Host Scott Jagow keeps you updated on business news worth talking about. Available daily at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 26th of August. Good to have you with us. The most famous line from Ted Kennedy's most famous speech came at the end of his concession at the 1980 Democratic Convention in New York City.
For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
Less remembered, but probably more important today, are some of the other things Kennedy said earlier in that speech about interest rates and health care, high inflation, and labor.
Let us pledge that there will be security for all those who are now at work, and let us pledge that there will be jobs for all who are out of work, and we will not compromise on the issues of jobs.
Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has this look back at Senator Kennedy's economic philosophy.
Ted Kennedy was a man of privilege who dedicated himself to defending opportunities for workers, students, and the sick. He was an early supporter of Senator Barack Obama's campaign for the White House. And today, President Obama said Kennedy's ideals are reflected in laws that have helped millions.
And seniors who know new dignity, in families that know new opportunity, in children who know education's promise, and in all who can pursue their dream in an America that is more equal and more just, including myself.
Despite his passion for liberal causes, Kennedy found legislative common ground with the other side. Norman Ornstein is the author of many books about Congress and politics.
My belief is that historians of the Senate, if you ask them to pick the top five senators of the 20th century, would almost uniformly include Kennedy on that list.
During 46 years in the Senate, Kennedy influenced a broad range of public policy, from labor and education to health care and the law.
Kennedy, in many ways, was the intellectual father of the kind of deregulation of the transportation world, for example, that we continue to live with.
In the 1970s, even before Ronald Reagan reached the White House, Kennedy shepherded bills lifting government control over trucking and the airlines. Richard Cohen covered those debates for National Journal.
There was a lot of opposition, including from Democrats in Congress who liked the old system, who created and benefited from the old system, but Kennedy was willing to take them on.
And found allies in the GOP to get them passed. Promoting the benefits of competition might seem unusual for a liberal, but biographer Adam Clymer says Kennedy figured less government control would help the little guy.
He was persuaded that airline deregulation would mean lower fares and competition and more people being able to fly. Flying before deregulation was uncommon. Now everybody flies.
Senator Kennedy believed access to health care is a universal right, and his skills have been missed in the current battle over improving the health care system. Here's Senator John McCain on ABC's This Week last Sunday.
It's huge that he's absent, not only because of my personal affection for him, but because I think that health care reform might be in a very different place today.
Still, Adam Clymer says the current health care struggle reflects Ted Kennedy's input.
He pushed Obama very hard to commit himself to universal coverage, which was not, if you remember, Obama's original position in the campaign. Obama's advocacy now is in part from pushing from Kennedy, who would always introduce him as saying, "And with Barack Obama as president, we'll have universal health care."
Clymer attributes Kennedy's success to the force of his personality. He took interest in the personal lives of his colleagues, and that compassion drew them into unusual alliances. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, things were generally quiet. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was on television today talking about the sale of General Motors' European unit, Opel. Her government is ponying up a lot of money to sweeten the deal for the eventual buyer. Part of what she's doing here is protecting auto workers' jobs and maybe her own as German elections loom in September. But negotiations that have dragged on for months now aren't helping anybody. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
GM agreed in principle to sell a majority stake in Opel back in May, the most favoured purchaser, a Canadian car parts maker with Russian backing. The German government gave its blessing and promised more than $6 billion worth of finance. But GM is clearly balking at the deal. The company is apparently nervous about its technology winding up in Russia. Analyst David Bailey says GM is now wondering, do we really have to sell? Times have changed since May.
What we've seen is GM transformed into Chapter 11 and out again. Much of its debts have been written off. It's in a stronger financial position. It can see now, potentially, a plan for its European operations whereby it could work with its US operations and make money.
But the German government and labour unions are disenchanted with GM, to say the least. They do not share the company's newfound confidence. They're still rooting for the Canadian-Russian deal, believing it's the best way to protect Opel's 25,000 German jobs. Analyst Professor Ferdinand Dudenhofer says the unions are threatening mass protests.
They will go in demonstration, they will go to the public, they will inform the public, they will ask the public to support, and that process will hurt the brand.
Hurting the Opel brand doesn't seem the best way to defend German jobs, but, says Dudenhofer, after 3 months of fruitless bargaining with GM, German anger has reached boiling point. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Even though Congress is out of town this month, the health care debate rolls on, as does the age-old question of how or whether political contributions affect how lawmakers vote when it comes down to it. In that vein, there's a new online tool out today that puts donations from interest groups up against a calendar of who voted which way and when. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
The website maplight.org has been helping ordinary Americans track money in politics for a couple years, but now Maplight is illuminating the timing of contributions and relevant votes. I checked out the new tool with the site's executive director, Daniel Newman.
I clicked on Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights Act of 2009.
Yes.
And then what?
So then what you're looking at is the date of each contribution that came in within a few days of that vote. So you can see, for example, like Representative Wilson from South Carolina, he received $2,000 from the American Bankers Association on April 27th. The American Bankers Association opposed this bill. And then 3 days later, Representative Wilson voted no on this bill.
So should we assume that Representative Wilson voted no because of the money he got from the American Bankers Association? Newman says not necessarily, but at least we have the data.
People really appreciate having an easy internet tool to access information that would take days or months of work to put together manually before.
Not everybody's jumping for joy over all this transparency. Jeff Patch with the Center for Competitive Politics says the tool can lead to the wrong conclusions.
This feature doesn't show how a particular congressman has supported an organization, for example, a union or a bankers association, over his or her career. It just shows a very small snippet of information that is more likely than not to be misleading.
He says it brings up the old question. Do campaign contributions alter lawmakers' votes, or do donors support candidates who share their values? I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It usually takes a while for Congress to catch on to exactly what Wall Street is doing. A couple of months ago, you might remember the big story was high-frequency trading, how super-speedy computers and complicated software could be skewing the markets in favor of just a handful of firms. Well, this week, the Senate asked the SEC to take a look at that practice. One estimate by the research firm Tab Group says almost three-quarters of all Wall Street trades are done by high-speed computers. But Jill Barshay explains the action doesn't really happen on Wall Street at all.
When Vasant Dhar was running a hedge fund, he worked out what a lot of big banks and top-flight money managers are realizing these days. You don't have to take big risks to make a lot of money. Instead, you just need speed.
If you can have that edge where you can get in your order, a millisecond faster than someone else, then then you're there before someone else was.
And being there first means making a fraction of a penny. Do that a few million times and you're talking real money. High-frequency trading is all about volume. The more trades you execute, the more money you make.
So it's like a cash machine with very little risk. And that's what's really appealing about it. And you just make money every day.
The high-frequency trader's building blocks are a lightning-fast computer and software that can buy shares by the bushel in the blink of an eye. There's one more key component, location. If you're in Greenwich, Connecticut, and you place an order to buy a stock, it could take half a thousandth of a second for the order to reach an exchange. But if your computer is sitting in the same building with the exchange's matching engines, the computers that put buyers and sellers together, your order gets to the exchange 50 times faster. Today, Vasant Dhar teaches trading strategies at New York University's Stern School of Business. But back when he was a high-frequency trader, he placed his computer at a co-location facility. This is the Equinix co-location facility. It's a squat cement warehouse the size of five football fields. And it's not on Wall Street. It's 4 miles west of Manhattan in Secaucus, New Jersey.
So if you look down the row here, you can see it's just cages upon cages upon cages.
Matt Mellis is an engineer at Equinix. He oversees the rows of darkened cages, each of which holds dozens of computers and servers.
Imagine your PC that sits under your desk or under your, in your home, and then imagine a big giant warehouse with 3 million of those, and that's kind of what you're looking at in a facility like this.
The computers belong to investment banks, brokerages, hedge funds. Some of them lease space from a company called Gravitas, which rents a cage in the facility and then sublets it. CEO Jayesh Punnatar has 40 clients. They like the high security and the climate control. But the biggest draw is the neighbors, which include some of the biggest stock exchanges in the country.
The New York Stock Exchange is also here, or some of the exchanges are also here. Like, we can't name the exchanges, but some of the exchanges also have terminated the servers here at this facility. So it gives them it gives a lot of the other private exchanges and clients equal access to them as if they were in downtown, on Wall Street, in the exchange space.
The New York area is dotted with these vast postmodern trading pits. They give even relatively small investors the same access as the big wealthy players have.
But you don't need to come here to do it. You can sit in your office in Midtown Manhattan or be in Greenwich and log into these computers and do all the work.
Punnatar charges a few thousand dollars a month for his services. Combine that with off-the-shelf trading programs and computers, and nearly anyone can juice their trading velocity. The possibility of making fast money, really fast money, is attracting more and more players to co-location facilities. Equinix doubled the size of its data center this summer. It plans to grow by another 50% next year. Even in these days of being connected wherever you are, it's still all about location, location, co-location. In New York,
I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
If you want to learn more about how high-frequency trading works, you can check out the whiteboard video on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, making sneakers worth waiting for.
Oh, man, I've been out here in the rain, didn't sleep last night. I'm going to wear them every day.
But first, let's do the numbers. All the major exchanges were up just a hair of 1% today. The Dow Industrials closed up 4 points, 9,543 the number. The NASDAQ barely made it into the black by less than a point, finished at 2,024. The S&P 500 also nudged higher by a fraction of a point, ending at 1,028. Good home sales news lifted home builders. Hovnanian Enterprises nailed a 9% gain. Lennar pushed up 4%. Pulte Homes rose nearly 2%. D.R. Horton ended the day 5.5% higher. Discount retailers cashed in as Dollar Tree reported some good quarterly results. General Electric fizzled 1.3% today. That on news it plans to sell its security unit. Bond prices rose. The yield on 10-year T-notes fell to 3.43%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Senator Edward M. Kennedy will lie in repose at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Boston. Condolence books will be available for the public to sign. The Commerce Department releases the preliminary second quarter gross domestic product report. And on August 27, 1953, Roman Holiday premiered. Audrey Hepburn took home an Oscar for that one. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Last time we had our senior business correspondent Bob Moon in here for a chat. He was telling us how the economy might not be as bad as it looks. Today he dropped by my office to say, you know, Kai, it might actually be worse than it looks. So we've brought him back in front of the microphones to explain himself. Bob can't have it both ways. What gives?
Well, Kai, today in Washington, the folks who guarantee our bank deposits were grappling with what could be the biggest hurdle yet, really, to genuine economic recovery. This was a meeting held by the FDIC.
Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
That's right. Let me see if I can illustrate what the head of the FDIC, Sheila Bair, says is giving her heartburn. I was just over at my bank. I won't name it, but it's one of the country's very biggest. It starts with the letter C. And I've brought back some exclusive sound of what's been happening for several months now, deep in the recesses of bank vaults across the country. See if you can tell what's going on here.
I'm afraid to guess, is frankly the truth.
Well, they keep playing kick the can. You hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, all their toxic assets are just being kicked along. All these bad securities, distressed mortgages, business loans that we haven't been talking a lot about lately. And now the FDIC is asking, how long should we let you bankers play this game of kick the can before you actually have to account for how much these bad debts are dragging down your bottom line? The banks say they're still not ready to, shall we say, cover their assets. This forbearance is known in the banking industry as delay and pray. And just to make it clear, here's how Harvard University banking professor Josh Lerner explained it to me.
Rather than letting the bloodletting happen immediately, hope that the banks will have enough profitability that many of the issues that they're facing will be addressed naturally through the fact that they will be generating additional profits.
Just to make sure we're clear here, what this strategy is hoping that these bad loans that are on the books will eventually be worth more money and the banks can get their money back.
Delay and pray.
Delay and pray, yes. Help me out, though, Bob, because bank failures are at a record level so far this year.
Yeah, 81 bank failures so far this year. Most of those failures happened, though, when time just ran out on a lot of these banks. They kicked the can as far as they could, and then they couldn't kick it anymore. What we're seeing in recent financial reports from Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, right down to many smaller regional banks, are these footnotes divulging that their loans are actually worth considerably less, tens of billions less in some cases, than their balance sheets actually indicate. Bank of America, for example, its latest interim financial report showed its loans were actually worth more than $64 billion less than its balance sheet shows.
Not two sets of books, because that, I think, is a felony, but it's two sets of numbers.
That's right. Two sets of numbers, what the loans would be worth today and what they might be worth someday, something like what your home is worth today and what you hope it's going to be worth when you have to sell it someday. Of course, not as many homeowners have been as successful at getting this kind of forbearance from their banks. But that's also part of this strategy, Kai, this delay and pray strategy, is pushing back loans and hoping your customers will stay afloat and be able to make their payments.
Yeah. How much money are we talking about in loans here?
Well, by some estimates, as much as $1 trillion in shaky bank assets.
Why don't the banks just deal with this now, Bob, and get it all out of the way, and then we can all move on?
Well, the question is, when is the right time? The FDIC was talking about that today. These new accounting rules will require the banks to show this stuff in their bottom line next year. The FDIC might give the banks a break on how much of a cash cushion they'd be required to have on hand to cover their losses once those rules take effect in January. The banks would like more time, but they're facing critics who say that just lets them goose their profit numbers and pay themselves bigger bonuses in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
We're marking the unofficial end of summer these next few weeks by asking some of our economist friends a simple question. With all the thinking you do on the job about economics, what do you think about when you have a little spare time? Today, one-time economic policymaker Robert Reich. He is just back from vacation, took a coast-to-coast drive with his son, during which he spent some time pondering how different the view can be from behind the windshield.
My road trip across America a few weeks ago with elder son Adam and his big dog Herb was one of the highlights of the summer. Not only was it great being with Adam and Herb, but I learned more about America by seeing it from the ground than reading dozens of reports. One surprise was how jammed our interstates are. Not because of more traffic than usual. In fact, the economic doldrums have actually reduced traffic, but because of all the highway construction and repair. The interstates are among the first targets of government stimulus money. Small comfort when we're moving 15 miles an hour on a road designed for 75, but at least good to know the money is getting out there, and our interstates will be all the better for it. Another surprise was how big a toll the recession is taking on main streets and malls across the country. I've never seen as much vacant retail and office space. Commercial real estate may be in bigger trouble than I imagined, the next shoe to drop in an economy that's otherwise showing a few signs of life. And it was easy to find rooms for the night. Even hotels and motels that normally wouldn't take in dogs as large as Herb were eager for the business. No surprise there, but I was surprised by the number of foreign visitors, mostly European and Asian, on the roads, taking advantage of the bargain rates. How could they afford it when most of their economies have been as battered by recession as ours? Then the answer came to me. Their countries have far more generous social safety nets, with unemployment benefits covering a big portion of their prior salaries and extending up to a year. They had the money to spend seeing America. All told, the view from the ground was sobering. I have to tell you, I didn't see many green shoots.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Send us your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. For the retail community, the summer of 09 will not be fondly remembered. Even the back-to-school season isn't working out so well. And it's not just pencil and notebook makers bemoaning slow sales. Clothing stores are, too. They're trying almost anything to sell more T-shirts, jeans, and shoes. And to get more traction, some sneaker makers are selling their wares very, very close to home. Kurt Nikisch reports now from WBUR in Boston.
See a line around a store nowadays, and you might think a new iPhone or video game is coming out. But earlier this summer in Cambridge, Massachusetts, more than 100 people waited in line for a week, mostly in the rain, to get their hands on a limited run of sneakers. Nick Furto waited under an umbrella, spitting chewing tobacco into an empty water bottle.
Oh, man, I've been out here in the rain, didn't sleep last night. I'm going to wear them every day.
Them is a pair of Blue Lobster Nike SB Dunk Lows, blue sneakers with fluorescent yellow laces. A boutique shoe store here teamed up with Nike to design them. Just 300 pairs went on sale, only here, for $250 each. Furto was determined to strut out with one of them.
The exclusiveness, people break their necks looking at you walking down the street.
News of the sale spread on blogs popular with kids who call themselves sneakerheads. The store fielded calls from around the country. Three teenagers even drove all the way from Cleveland to stand in line. It was a minor marketing coup for Nike.
It's almost like, you know, a walking billboard for them.
That's Marshall Cohen. He follows the sports apparel market for NPD Group. He says the recession has forced sneaker companies to slash marketing budgets. The problem is consumers are harder to reach during a downturn. So Cohen says instead of investing in national ad buys that are costly and anonymous, sneaker companies are trying more small-scale efforts. So-called hyper-local marketing tries to connect with consumers where they shop and get them to help spread the message for companies.
This is the product and the consumer that's going to be talking about this and giving them all kinds of leverage against their competition.
Competition that's getting stiffer all the time. Although clothing sales are down overall, sneakers are one of the few products that are still selling. The global sneaker market is worth almost $30 billion, and that's attracting new players like Under Armour to a field already crowded with heavyweights like Nike, Adidas, and Puma. So to try to keep its edge, Puma just launched an ad campaign in a few U.S. cities that showcases some of its workers at the company's local retail stores.
Hi, my name is Basma, and I'm from Houston, and I work at the Houston Galleries.
The global marketing officer for Puma, Antonio Bertone, says this new campaign doesn't mean that his company is dropping its sports stars. He was thrilled to see sprinter Usain Bolt shatter a world record recently in bright orange Puma racers. But Bertone thinks by letting consumers get to know sales associates at their local Puma store, they'll be more interested in getting to know the brand and its products.
Never mind the United States, not even East Coast, West Coast. I think brands are going to have to think city by city, you know, in terms of how to effectively communicate to consumers and hope that there's a spillover effect into other markets.
Expect more hyper-local campaigns spilling over to you. The recession is changing the race, and even the biggest sneaker companies are finding that little steps may be the way to win it. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, we all know how bad things are budget-wise here in the Golden State, but now we've got the first actual proof that California just ain't what it used to be. A survey this week by the State Department of Finance shows the total value of all taxable property here, that's residential, real estate, commercial buildings, everything, fell almost 2.5% last year. That's the first time that has happened since, yes, the Great Depression, due in large part, analysts say, to real estate that was way overpriced to begin with. On a related note, the city of Malibu, California, has been able to buy its own city hall for the first time. Crazy property values out by the beach had the city renting for years. And, of course, the city bought at a foreclosure auction. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow added 4 points, almost 1%. The Nasdaq rose less than a point. The S&P 500 gained a fraction of 1 point again, way less than 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, building our way out of disaster.
The great common denominator is that people rise to the occasion and often do so with joy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.